The second case for oral argument this morning is George Johnson and Johnson Ford Lincoln Mercury versus Lawrence Koss. For the appellant, Lawrence Koss is Robert Anderson, an attorney from Peer. And for the appellees is Mr. Kenneth Barker, an attorney from Belle Fouche. The appellant may proceed.
Please the court, Mr. Chief Justice and Mr. Barker. As you know, I'm Rob Anderson. I'm from Peer, and I represent the defendant and appellant Lawrence Koss. We're here to ask this court to reverse a judgment which was entered by the trial court on a summary judgment against Koss in favor of the plaintiff Johnson, to direct the trial court to enter judgment instead for Koss, dismissing the plaintiff's complaint in the original action, or in the alternative to remand it for trial. The dispute here between these parties centers around a fairly complex purchase agreement for a new and used car dealership in Spearfish. It was never consummated due to a condition precedent which was not met and never satisfied, despite Koss's efforts to do that. By its own terms, because that condition wasn't satisfied, the agreement itself and the transaction are null and void. This case is before this court on summary judgment. I wanted to talk just very briefly about the standard of review. I know the court is more than familiar with that, but I still think it's important in this case. The moving party, of course, has the burden to show the absence of any issues of genuine issues of material fact and an entitlement to judgment as a matter of law. Not only must there be no genuine issues of material fact relative to legitimate issues in the case, there can't be any inferences which can be drawn from those facts. In this case, we respectfully submit that there are a lot of disputes of fact which bear on Johnson's entitlement to recover against costs, and even more so, there are a lot of inferences to be drawn from those facts that do the same. If this court or a trial court is in a position of having to decide or think about who's being truthful, does A refute B or does B refute A, who will or might prevail at trial, who do I believe, who's more credible, if you have to ask those questions about issues or issues of fact or questions to be decided in the underlying case, it almost universally means that a summary judgment is not appropriate. We think this is a classic case like that. Summary judgment is not appropriate because those kind of questions have to be asked about very significant facts.
Well, the trial court didn't agree with you. What did it conclude? It was simply interpreting a written document?
I think so, right. I think it did. I don't want to go, unless you want me to do that right now, talk about the litany of the facts that I think are disputed, but I think I can answer your question without doing that. I think the trial court, for a couple reasons, misinterpreted the issues before it. I think its memorandum opinion shows that. And the trial court's misinterpretation, I think, or misapprehension, was based more on a question of law or a question of contractual interpretation than on deciding whether there were issues of material fact. I'll touch on more on this later, but the trial court looked at this condition precedent and said, hey, this manager, Mark Goodrich in this case, is not a party to this agreement. Therefore, Koss had full control of whether or not this was going to be satisfied. Well, that is absolutely clear, not even in dispute, that Koss did not have full control of satisfying this condition. It was Ford Motor Company's issue, in part. And the judge said, I'm paraphrasing, but I do have a copy of his opinion, which I want to bring to the court's attention later, verbatim, but I think the trial court said, if it were otherwise, I would have ruled differently. Well, it was otherwise. I think the trial court misapprehended that question.
Did you get an opportunity to argue everything you claimed to be a genuine issue of material fact before Judge Johnson?
I think we presented it, and I think we argued it. I don't know if we argued it, Your Honor. I think we presented it to the court. If it wasn't argued, it was, you know, it was by omission, not by intention, but we presented the affidavits to the court. Later, of course, we presented that letter of Mr. Grodahl's, which was not part of the record at the time we had the hearing on the summary judgment motion.
And the depositions were all available?
There were no depositions. It was all affidavits.
Why was that letter submitted the second time?
I don't have a good answer for that, Your Honor. We were, you know, I think you probably read the transcript from the summary judgment hearing, which is part of the record here. That letter was omitted from the from the filings made to the circuit court. The judge raised, Judge Johnson raised a question about what communications had been made, if any, to the plaintiff, telling him what was happening here. And I recalled at that time there was a letter. I didn't write it, but I remembered then it had been in the record. It was written by Mr. Grodahl, who was a representative of Mr. Cost. Mr. Barker remembered that there was a letter. He stipulated that we could supplement the record later and submit some additional arguments by in writing to the court, which we did. That's how it got there. Back in this whole thing back began back in June of 1999 or early 1999 when the parties negotiated about the sale of this agreement, and they ultimately signed the agreement in January of 2000, which included a great number of provisions, but I wanted to call the court's attention to paragraph 16, which talks about the transfer of franchises. Obviously, this is the sale of a new car business, and the transfer of the franchises by the franchisor, Ford Motor Company, was significant. In part, that paragraph reads, in the event the consent and approval of Ford Motor Company or any other entity necessary to approve and effectively transfer the Ford Lincoln Mercury franchise to purchaser is not obtained, then this transaction in its entirety and this agreement in its entirety is null and void. It's also mentioned again in paragraph 17D. It was clear that the parties intended and knew that the transfer of the franchise was significant. It was made a condition precedent to closing the transaction. The terms are clear and it's unambiguous. Not only that, the inclusion of this language was a clear recognition by the parties that there was a possibility that the franchise could not be transferred, in which case the whole deal was off. That agreement, by the way, is attached to, I think, Mr. Barker's brief as the appendix and also to the affidavit of Grodahl.
If I understand the facts correctly, though, the issue of consent by Ford was never actually reached because your client contacted Ford and aborted the process. That's the allegation, anyway.
I don't think that's, I would disagree with that characterization. I'll tell you why. The Cost went to work he personally and through his employees to try to make this deal go, even before they signed the agreement in January of 2000. There is in the record a letter written to a potential manager that he had identified, Mark Goodrich, outlining a compensation plan and arrangement with him that was written even before the agreement was signed. Ford was in total control of whether this franchise was going to be transferred. Ford imposed conditions on ownership, who can own it, who can't own it, how much you have to own, financing, how much can be financed, how much can be credit, how much can be your credit, how much can be your credit, how much has to be equity that's initially contributed to the purchase. Management, and this is the critical part, Mr. Cost could not have made this deal go by himself. He was not, and everyone knows it and agrees with it, approved by Ford to be an on-site manager of this business. Before the franchise could be transferred, Ford had to approve an on-site manager who had the financial capability to be a substantial owner, who had the experience and professional capability to run a car dealership, and that person had to be satisfactory to Ford, and obviously to Cost. He's putting $4 to $8 million of his money in this deal. He's not going to accept just anybody. Now, he identified Mr. Goodrich. They made a proposal. Ford said, no, that proposal is not acceptable. They reworked it, I think, a couple of times, and it never was acceptable. The appellee in this case contends that we prevented Ford from telling us whether this was going to be approved or not approved. But there's an issue of fact on that. Mr. Grodahl says he was in constant communications with the people at Ford, at least the first level of approval at Ford Motor Company.
You know, I wasn't quite clear on the problem there. Is did Mr. Cost intend to be an investor owner rather than a manager? And Ford said, no, our owners are also the managers.
I don't know that I can answer that, but I think it was clear to everybody before the agreement was signed that there had to be a manager approved by Ford and that Mr. Cost was not going to be that person. In fact, to Ford, he could not be that person. That never changed. So I guess to answer your question, by January 2000, I think it's a fair statement to say that it was not Cost's intention to be the on-site manager of the business. I think that's right.
But isn't there evidence from the Ford person who was going to make this ultimate decision? Isn't there evidence from that person to the effect that his consent was never obtained, never sought, because although they were working towards consent, your client at some point decided that they, on their own, could not obtain their consent.
I think what the Ford, the affidavit from Mr. Waite, who's the Ford Motor Company representative, says is that we never rejected the application. And there was never a written rejection of any application. However, Mr. Grodahl, in his affidavit and in his letter, which was written to Mr. Johnson, well before this litigation commenced, I mean, you can look at the letter and say, here's what Mr. Grodahl tells Johnson in June of 2000. It says, we can't satisfy these conditions. Mr. Grodahl says he was told by Ford the deal that they thought they could work out was not acceptable. And that's what Mr. Grodahl says in his affidavit. Mr. Waite, as I recall, never says anywhere that anything would have been approved had a formal written application been made. And I guess, I don't know that, that's an issue here, I think.
Are you claiming that Ford, throughout these lengthy back and forth negotiations, changed its position or requirements, or were they consistent and your client consistently failed to meet them?
No, I think Mr. Grodahl's affidavit makes it clear that the original, maybe at two different steps, they were led to believe that one type of organization and one type of relationship with Mr. Goodrich was acceptable. Ford later said it wasn't. The initial plan was to be a 50-50 owner. I believe that they felt that that was acceptable. Ford didn't approve that. They required a majority owner. The original plan was for $1 million of cash to be contributed into the operation as initial capital in addition to substantial credit. That went up to $1.4 million at some point. There were other things that they discussed with Ford, so I don't know that Ford changed their position as much as their position was refined over time, and Koss modified his position to meet those requirements on several occasions. He agreed to the additional capitalization.
So you're saying this back and forth process between your client and Ford is part of the question of fact as far as this good faith attempt to comply?
That's right. That clearly is. I think that's right.
And that he had, in essence, no control over Ford's position or whether it changed?
He had no control over Ford's position or requirements, which were Ford's alone to impose on the transfer of the franchise. He obviously had control to some degree over whether he could meet those conditions. And I think the record is clear that he tried to meet those conditions. He went to a lot of time and a lot of expense to meet those conditions. Ultimately, they could not be met under these circumstances. Mr. Grodahl's affidavit states, we look for other managers. These aren't people you can find on every street corner, I am assuming. Plus, I think that the position taken by Johnson, if you look at it in this case, is that Koss should have been forced to accept anybody as a business partner here. That can hardly be the case under these circumstances. He's putting in a lot of money. He's making a big investment. I think he's the fact that he may not approve and be able to comply with all these requirements is certainly not evidence of a lack of good faith in his effort to do so.
You know, if he made a substantial effort, why didn't he put up the $100,000?
Well, the check was written and delivered to his accountant, but it never got into the escrow account. That's true.
But why? I mean, why? Yeah, that's pretty strong evidence of really whether you want to do this deal or not.
I don't think it is, Your Honor, when you look at all the other facts in totality, but I don't think it's in the record as to why it wasn't. The check is written. The check is still there. Not in my possession, but it's still there to my knowledge.
Is there anything in the record at the time of the negotiations prior to the contract being drafted and signed that either party or both anticipated problems with Ford? Is there anything in the record on that?
I don't think there's anything in the record on whether either party anticipated there'd be particular problems in getting the franchise approved. I think they probably realize the franchise approval is something that can be fairly exacting. But I do think it's significant evidence in the record that in the agreement itself, the condition precedent to the enforcement of the agreement is, in fact, the approval of the franchise transfer. That's if not explicit, it's an implicit recognition that that could be a problem. And if it's a problem, obviously the transaction can't go. Now, thinking back to, did that respond to your question?
Yes.
Okay. Thinking back to Justice Konenkamp's question about whether this was rejected or not approved or did we abandon it, Mr. Grodal's affidavit makes it clear he was told that under the circumstances that then existed by sometime spring of 2000, they weren't going to satisfy Ford's current requirements. He wrote that letter in June of 2000 to Mr. Johnson, telling him that. I don't know that it would have made more sense to fill out a written application. And of course, written applications have been filled out. There's no dispute here that Mr. Koss had provided all of the applications, all of the personal information, all of the financial information that he was required to provide. That's not an issue. He did that. Ford had it for some time. But the question is, I mean, does he have to go to the length of submitting a written application when his agent, Mr. Grodal, is advised that under these circumstances we can't make this deal work? I don't think so. But.
And so if I understand your argument, basically your client ran into two problems with Ford. One was who was going to be the manager, and secondly was how much equity he was going to put in the business, right?
Ownership interest between the manager and Mr. Koss, the financial aspect, including capitalization and the credit. That's right.
Okay. Now, did that change from before the agreement was signed until after the agreement was signed, or was that 51%, at 50.1% and the $1.47 million deal, were those two changes after the agreement had been signed?
I don't know that anybody, there's nothing in the record to indicate, and I don't know whether Ford ever made all these things known to these people before the agreement was signed, if that's what you're asking. I don't know that, and there's no evidence of that. The initial proposal between Koss and Goodrich was a 50-50 relationship. It's described in a letter to Goodrich that's attached to the Grodal affidavit. That was the original proposal made before the agreement was signed. Ford later said that's not acceptable. You have to have a majority owner.
Mr. Anderson, what exactly then will the jury, if this goes to a jury or the court, what fact finding will they be making that they haven't, that already isn't there?
I think you have to make fact finding as to what Koss did to make this deal work, what efforts he made to make the transaction to work towards consummation of the transaction, whether those efforts were made in good faith or whether in some place, in some way, they lack good faith, because I think the law is pretty clear. Other than something he did to prevent the closing of this transaction pursuant to the terms of the agreement, he is fully entitled to rely on that unsatisfied condition precedent to bar the enforcement of the agreement. And there are facts. I mean, I think, you know, what did Ford require? There seems to be some dispute on that. Did Ford indeed tell Grodal that they wouldn't approve the transaction in the form it existed, say, in the spring of 2000 before Grodal wrote the letter? Did Goodrich and Koss, was their relationship able to satisfy, would have it ultimately satisfied Ford or not? Would Ford have rejected this, or did Ford say that it wouldn't be approved? Would Ford have approved it? Did Koss attempt in good faith to make this deal work? I think those are all fact questions that need to be decided.
Were the elements of the prevention doctrine briefed to the trial court?
No, I don't think so.
Why is that?
I don't know. I mean, I argued on the my argument was based on the condition precedent, and I think what the trial court did was make a decision based on the prevention doctrine anyway, you know, doing, I believe it was the wrong thing, but for the sake of the expression, doing the right thing for a reason that we hadn't argued. I think it was the wrong thing, but I think the trial court found that we had done something to prevent the consummation of this transaction. Therefore, we should be prevented from relying on that unfulfilled condition. I want one question I wanted to bring up before I went farther is that in his responsive brief, Johnson makes the argument that affidavit of Grodal and the letters and a number of other things are inadmissible parole evidence here. And I should have submitted a supplemental authority on this, because after the briefing in this case was done, this case decided Hofelt v. Mailing, which really dealt with exactly the same issue. And this court contended that the parole evidence rule was inapplicable in a dispute which considered the parties' discussions and conduct which followed the execution of an unambiguous contract.
Under our rules, if you're citing late authority, not in your brief, you should file with the court an original. 7 copies, Shirley?
I will do that, Your Honor. And the case, in fact, discussed a situation very much like ours. It discussed conduct of the parties after the execution of an unambiguous agreement, and discussed it in the context of the parole evidence rule not applying, ruling that, hey, you can show what people did or failed to do in their effort to satisfy or comply with the agreement or consummate an agreement. So I wanted to bring that to the court's attention. In terms of the circuit court opinion, I'm out of time. So.
You are.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Barker, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court and counsel, I'm glad to be here this morning representing Mr. Johnson and his business, Johnson Ford of Spearfish. Let me begin by saying that the singular issue before the court is simply whether Mr. Koss prevented Ford Motor Company from making a decision on the new dealership application. The trial court found, indeed, that Mr. Koss prevented that opportunity from occurring. That singular fact is undisputed and uncontested in any of the affidavits that have been submitted, any of the evidence that's been submitted, and any of the arguments that have been presented to this court.
So you concede to decide this case, you have to go beyond the four corners of the agreement?
I don't concede that, with all due respect, Your Honor. The four corners of the agreement dictate. Mr. Anderson's argument, Mr. Costa's argument, is simply this, is that there was a condition precedent that hadn't been fulfilled. And we agree with that. We agree with it wholeheartedly, and there is no dispute. We also agree with the fact that the four corners of the document dictate. However, in order to arrive at the proper conclusion in this case, you have to interpret both paragraph 16 with paragraph 9. Paragraph 16 that Mr. Anderson just cited to the court and cited in his brief is the provision that requires Ford Motor Company's approval of the franchise transfer. Curiously, what isn't mentioned either in argument today or on brief by Mr. Koss is paragraph 9, which says that you have to pay at the signing of the agreement $100,000 into escrow. And in the event of non-performance, that $100,000 non-performance due to an act of the purchaser, that $100,000 goes back to the seller. You can't interpret paragraph 16 without the benefit of paragraph 9. Otherwise, neither one would have meaning. And of course, it's a fundamental proposition of interpretation of contracts that you have to read the entire agreement together. The sequence of events is very curious here.
Before you go on to that, isn't the failure to comply with paragraph 9 simply an evidence that creates some inference about whether Mr. Koss really was using substantial efforts to consummate this transaction?
That's all it is. I can't say that it's more. In all honesty, I can't stand here before you that the issue is going to be resolved simply on that fact. It cannot be. Certainly, it does tell you that Mr. Koss had the intention of going into this agreement, getting the benefits from it if he could do so, and in the event he found that he could not, he was going to bail out. But unfortunately, he bailed out before Ford Motor Company could make a decision. And what that does is place an undue burden on my client, Mr. Johnson, because there was never any information elicited from Ford Motor Company what was wrong with the new dealer application, something that Johnson Ford and Doug Johnson could evaluate. Why is it, Ford, that you don't approve this franchise transfer to Mr. Lawrence Koss? What is it? He never
was your client given copies of the ongoing correspondence back and forth between Ford and Koss?
No, Your Honor, and there's nothing in the record to suggest that. The one letter that he did get was from Mr. Grodal. He received that letter on June 27th of 2000, and that was 6 weeks after Grodal had called Ford Motor Company and said, we're out. We're not going to go through with this deal. This whole transaction began actually in 1998, and it's very curious about those facts because it was Mr. Koss who approached our client, Mr. Johnson, and said, I would like to buy your dealership. That was the same time, if you look at Exhibit C to Grodal's first affidavit, that was about the same time that Mr. Koss, who was CEO and chairman of a corporation called Green Tree Financial, was actually selling to Conseco, which are both, as you know, all know, are national corporations. And so, anyway, he approached during the same time period, he approached Mr. Johnson. That ensued then a two-year negotiation process, which culminated in the agreement, which, as Mr. Anderson pointed out, was signed in January of 2000. Prior to that, everybody knew that Mr. Koss would not be approved as a dealer, as the on-site manager, excuse me. In March of 1999, 9 months before the agreement was ever signed, they approached Mark Goodrich to see if he would come to work as the on-site manager. And Ford had indicated that he had the necessary credentials to be approved, and indeed took over that position before the agreement was even signed. At the time that he submitted his affidavit in this case, he was the on-site manager for Johnson Ford. And that's, I think, a fact that is omitted. So the fact of his credentials or his qualifications as an on-site manager is a moot issue. He was, and he is today. As we said,
that including financial contribution and the purchase?
Right, and that's an interesting concept, too. Mr. Cost attempts to create a material issue of fact when there is none to create. On the capital contribution issue specifically, if you look again at Exhibit C to Mr. Grodal's first affidavit, you look at the application form, and in that it suggests, and it doesn't suggest, it states very plainly that Mr. Cost is going to be the 50.1% owner, and that Mr. Goodrich is going to be 49.9% owner. That is inconsistent with the second affidavit that was filed that says that there was some dispute with Ford that said because there was a 50-50 ownership. That issue had been resolved long before the application had ever been submitted. Exhibit C and Mr. Grodal's affidavits are very, very telling. And it's telling not for what they say necessarily, but for what it doesn't say. You will notice in his affidavits, he never suggests, he never denies the fact that I told Ford Motor Company that this deal is off. He never disputes that fact. And either he's very careful, and as an officer of the court, he knows he was treading on thin ice. He called Ford Motor Company on May 3rd, 2000. It was 6 weeks later, after some inquiry from me, that he wrote a letter to Doug Johnson and said, I declare the agreement null and void.
But isn't there a time when a party can say that the condition just is not ever going to be met? I mean, do they have to go through an impossible process of dealing with all of Ford's refinements, quibbles, whatever you want to call it, to until they get a paper rejection? Or are they entitled to say, look, this isn't that, we can see now that we're never going to be able to meet their conditions, and we're going to stop this process?
Your Honor, no. I think there has to be a decision. In order to protect the interest of both parties, there's two parties to this contract, not only Mr. Cost, although he would like this court to believe that he's the only party to it, there's also Mr. Johnson. In order for Mr. Johnson to protect his rights, he needs a decision from Ford Motor Company, yay or nay, so that at least he's in a position to be able to question Ford, saying, why won't you approve this? Give me the specific reasons. If you read carefully on the briefs, it's never said exactly why Ford Motor Company said this deal wouldn't work, because the capitalization requirements are inconsistent also, just as inconsistent as the ownership requirements. If you notice, there was a memo to Mark Goodrich from Mr. Grodal in April of 2000, and that said, we anticipate the capitalization requirements to be $2.5 million of this $8 million purchase. Then, after the fact, when we decide that we're going to pursue our rights in this action, he says, well, wait a minute, Ford Motor Company, we could never meet Ford Motor Company's capitalization requirements of $1.4 million. Well, wait a minute. That's less than what you anticipated in the documents leading into the submission of the application of new dealership. That's inconsistent, as well as it is inconsistent to now suggest before the court in affidavit that the 50-50 requirement was a deal breaker.
Doesn't that raise questions of fact?
It certainly does not, Your Honor. And the reason why is because the question of fact is simply this. Did Mr. Koss unilaterally declare the contract null and void before Ford Motor Company had an opportunity to make its decision on the application?
But when you point out inconsistencies, you repeatedly use that word in it. It prompted Justice Saber's question. When you use the word inconsistently, That's kind of a red flag in a summary judgment case.
And I agree that normally it would be. And my position is this, is we don't even get to the inconsistencies. And I guess what I'm requesting that the court do is make the decision, make its decision in affirming Judge Johnson's judgment on the four corners of the documents and on the affidavits that were submitted, because there isn't any inconsistency as to the material issue of fact. However, if you want to go to the second step, and as Mr. Anderson has suggested, arrive at some inferences of fact that may be in favor of Mr. Koss, I'm saying even those inferences are inconsistent, Justice Center. They're inconsistent. Mr. Grodal's affidavits are completely inconsistent, one to the other, which raises another issue. There was a lot made of Judge Johnson's opinion letter, which was drafted and submitted to counsel on the motion for reconsideration. This was his second opportunity to decide the merits of this case. That opinion letter needs to be looked at and judged in the context in which it was submitted. Mr. Anderson's motion for reconsideration centered only on the letter that was sent to my client 6 weeks after the fact. And he said, and the issue was simply this to Judge Johnson, does this letter create sufficient issues of fact that requires you to reverse your prior decision? And so Judge Johnson's letter centers simply on that issue, not on all the other facts that he found in the first decision, and that is that Mr. Koss abandoned his effort to seek a Ford Motor Company franchise. And I think it's significant.
Let me go to, it's somewhat of an aside, but when did Mr. Johnson find out that that Mr. Koss did not deposit in escrow the $100,000 check?
He found that out within the first month of January of 2000.
Did he ever make a demand in writing on Koss to do it?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Several times.
And they were ignored.
And the decision was made to go forward anyway in trying to put this agreement together, thinking that probably in the end it wouldn't make that much difference. And of course, in hindsight, it does, and it did.
He would have had an option there, wouldn't he, to have said back to Koss, look, that's a condition of this agreement. If you don't put the $100,000 in there, the deal's off, and I'm not considering selling to you, wouldn't he?
Yes, and he certainly would have had that option, and he didn't take that option. He, at his own risk, I admit that, went forward in hoping that the deal would be consummated. The word used in the agreement that was proposed by Mr. Koss himself.
Throughout this whole period of time, did you represent Mr. Johnson and did Mr. Anderson represent Mr. Koss?
Yes. Yes, we did. Although I think in fairness to both of us, the negotiations went on outside of us. There were people that Mr. Koss had who were experienced in these types of issues involving dealerships. And Mr. Johnson, of course, had his relationship, long-term relationship with Ford Motor Company. And so the transaction, once the agreement was signed, went on largely without our day-to-day participation.
But the two of you worked together to come up with that agreement?
Yes. It was proposed by Mr. Koss. And actually, it was proposed by, I believe, Mr. Grodal is where the agreement first came from. And then it was, of course, modified in the process of negotiations. And as the court's aptly noted, executed in January of 2000.
Is there anything in the record that would indicate that the failure of Koss to deposit this $100,000 somehow affected Ford's position on looking at the Koss application?
No. To my knowledge, Ford was unaware of that. It was never made an issue.
So, well, that money, earnest money, was not a requirement of Ford. Ford didn't care about it.
No, that was deemed to be a contractual arrangement or relationship between the two parties, and that was it. So, it never affected that part of it. But it is significant that Ford Motor Company, and there's been four affidavits that were submitted in this case. In order for the court to arrive at the decision that Mr. Koss wants, it would have to ignore three of those four affidavits. It would instead have to rely on a fourth affidavit filed by Mr. Grodal, actually two affidavits filed by Mr. Grodal, who is the person, the representative of Lawrence Koss, who declared the contract null and void. I would say that his interests are pretty self-serving. And it's also...
Doesn't that go to credibility, which goes to genuine issues of material fact?
It does, but when there is no genuine issue of material fact, it does test his credibility, but as I've suggested before...
Continuing to say that doesn't make it so, you know, is what's bothering me.
I agree with that, but this is simply a breach of contract action. That's all it is. And the four corners of the contract dictate. And as a result of the defenses that were brought up in the case, we've had to respond. And so we have responded, but we pointed out the inconsistencies in that defense. And the inconsistencies in that defense, I think, strengthen the reason why this case ought to be decided on the four corners of the contract.
But don't you agree that Judge Johnson really did decide this on the prevention doctrine, not simply on the four corners of the contract?
He did not decide it on the prevention doctrine.
Well, he didn't use the words. But when he says that it's CASA's fault,
yes,
that formal approval was not obtained, that's in essence invoking the doctrine.
It certainly is. Without saying it, that's exactly what he did. And he said, yes, it was abandoned due to an act of the purchaser. And so that is the essence of Section 245 of the Restatement of Contracts called the Prevention Doctrine, which we've briefed to the court on both sides. But I guess I would close by saying that the person who is asking this court for relief, Mr. Koss, is a person who appears through his counsel here who has never abided by the terms of the agreement from the day he executed on January 12th of 2000. As pointed out by Justice Center, he's never bothered, despite repeated requests, to submit the $100,000 to escrow. And he's now here before the court asking it to protect him from an action that Judge Johnson, one of the most experienced and respected trial court judges in our state, decided and considered twice. Judge Johnson looked at these issues twice, very carefully, and the facts were before him, and he decided that this agreement, or this the resolution of this issue, should be decided simply on the basis of the contract. And I would urge the court to affirm Judge Johnson. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Barker. Mr. Anderson, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. In terms of the allegation that Koss bailed out before Ford could make a decision, we have Mr. Grodahl's affidavit that says Ford says they wouldn't have approved it. It brings up the question raised by Justice Konenkamp before. Does that mean we have to go through the formalities of applying under terms and conditions which we have been told verbally aren't going to work? I mean, I think it would be similar to if I were going to buy Mr. Barker's law practice and I were a suspended or disbarred attorney and the condition precedent was I had to be readmitted to practice before the agreement could be enforced. And I called the Board of Bar Examiners and I said, I'm ready to apply, and they tell me, ABC, you're wasting your time. You're not going to get back in. Such circumstances could exist. I don't think I'd be required to have to fill out that written application and get a formal rejection if we all... if those facts were true. And here, since we're here on summary judgment, we have to accept the proposition those facts are in fact true, but they may be disputed. One thing that Mr. Barker brought up, I wanted to mention that clearly was a problem here, and it was raised in Mr. Grodahl's letter of June 27, 2000, and that is the fact that the person who we identified as a business partner, if you will, and an on-site manager of this business, went to work for Mr. Johnson before the deal was even closed. And in Mr. Grodahl's letter, he says, and he's referring to a letter from Mr. Barker that was sent to him, Mr. Barker also stated in that letter that, quote, the manager who was hired at Mr. Koss's direction, comma, Mark Goodrich, close quote. Then Grodahl goes on to say, it was never the desire of Mr. Koss, much less the direction, that Mr. Goodrich become an employee of Johnson Ford prior to closing under this agreement. I don't know what problems that created, but it clearly was a problem. Third, paragraph 16 and paragraph 9 we talked about. I think paragraph 16, you can interpret the contract and look at paragraph 16 and describe and decide this case based on the condition precedent argument and give full all the credit in the world to the provisions of paragraph 9, because in essence, if you decide that the transaction was not consummated because of an act of cost, you're deciding one on the prevention doctrine, and you're deciding that, hey, in that case, Johnson gets the escrow money. So one final comment on the trial court's opinion, which I referred to before. And Judge Johnson mentioned there is no reference to Goodrich or any other co-ownership arrangement. That's very true. There isn't in the agreement. But that's implicit in the condition precedent requiring the franchise transfer approval, because Ford made it clear that in order for that transfer to occur, there had to be a person, not Goodrich, but somebody like him that would satisfy those requirements. The trial court went on to say, in no way is the Johnson cost transaction conditioned upon Ford Motor Company transferring the franchises to a corporation in which cost is a 50.1% owner, or to cost as an absentee owner. None of the negotiations between cost and Goodrich are conditions of the asset purchase agreement. Again, at the first level, that's true, but they are necessary to the consummation of that agreement because of Ford's requirements. And what Mr. Barker said was right. They knew by that time that cost couldn't, either wouldn't personally go out there and manage it, or if he wanted to, Ford wouldn't approve him. I think for all these reasons, this is a classic example of deciding whether you ignore this affidavit and accept this affidavit. It's not a case that should have been decided on summary judgment, and we ask the court to reverse on that basis.
I have a question.
Sure. Thank you.
Let's assume the court's willing to say that there are genuine issues of material fact and it should be reversed. As a matter of fairness, shouldn't your client be required to put $100,000 into escrow before you ever get that opportunity to go back and see what the whole card of Judge Johnson is?
I'd be hard-pressed to argue against that proposition.
I was thinking that too, but just wanted to know what you had to say.
Okay. Thank you. Is that
any
all?
Further questions from the court? If not, thank you, Mr. Anderson. Court will be in recess 10 minutes.